All righty, folks. We're going to bring you to order the meeting of the Public Safety Security Policy and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call.
Chairman Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grassel.
Here.
Representative Howe.
President.
Representative Lomer.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Here. Team members, approve a motion here or accept a motion for the approval of the minutes? Who? Okay, Representative Howell moves the minutes for February 21st. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, folks, what we have today on the order is we're going to hear a couple of bills before what are admittedly the more controversial bills in the end. We're going to hear one by Representative Neuberger, followed by Representative O'Driscoll, and then we'll move into the Zerwas and Lomer bills. What I would ask from the crowd is hopefully we'll have an orderly meeting here. We'll allow you to testify, come to the table, and vent your grievances on the bill if you have any, and then afterwards, towards the end, before noon, we'll take a vote on the bill. So, all right. The first one up will be Representative Neuberger, and you remember the committee, so you can move your own bill. You know where it's going?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My motion is to pass this bill and move it on to the Tax Committee. House File 115, this is round two for this bill. We heard this last session. It simply addresses first responders. As many of you know, I am one, acutely aware of the industry. In the past, when I first started in the industry, you could stop and get lunch. That's not the case anymore. Currently, most of your larger ambulance services are running about 75,000 calls a year, and it is very typical for us to start a 12-hour shift. Your truck's not even started before you get your first call, and then generally you stay at least an hour past the end of your shift because we are just that busy. Eating has become a difficulty for a lot of folks. Because of OSHA regulations, we can't keep food in the back of the ambulance, nor would I want to. We have a very tight and confined space up front. Simply put, members and Mr. Chair, Supermom makes most of my meals. So at this point, what we're doing here, House File 115 would allow for first responders, as defined in the bill, simply to deduct the cost of up to $15 per day of their meals from their taxes. If you work under 21 hours a week, you can do it twice a week. If you work over 21 hours a week, you can do it four times a week. This would include ambulance service personnel, emergency responders, volunteer ambulance, full-time firefighters, and volunteer firefighters. What this would also do for greater Minnesota members is it would really help as an incentive to recruit volunteers to into a fire service or an ambulance service, or to help keep them where we have very, very significant staffing issues. This is a very small bone that we can throw to these people, but it would be very effective. What the first responders are not asking for, they're not asking for the taxpayers to buy them their meals. They're simply asking that they can deduct the cost of their meals from their taxes. That's all that they were asking. And with that, members, I would be happy to stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Neuberger. I would just like to throw out there that Supermoms is in my district. Great company.
Yes.
So I will be supporting your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from members? Any public testimony on this bill? Okay, if not, do you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you, members, for your time. I'd like to renew my motion to pass House File 115 and refer it to the Tax Committee under the auspices of Chair Davids.
Hey, folks, you've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative Newbern. Representative O'Driscoll, House File 1261. The Chair will move House File 261, not 1261. be recommended to re-referred to, or this one we're going to lay over for possible inclusion. Sorry about that, Representative Driscoll. Are there any amendments? Okay, Representative O'Driscoll, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Public Safety Committee, Safety and Security Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to be here. This is the third biennium that I brought this bill forward, and I've always been somewhat reluctant to make it a part of base budgeting, but it asks for $100,000 for each of the 2 years of the next biennium. The genesis of the bill is for de-escalation training to be able to provide resources and funding for training of those folks who are in law enforcement and other public safety areas such as fire and first responders and ambulance and the like. One of the situations that we have is we are having returning veterans coming back to Minnesota from their noble service in our country is that not everybody gets home all at the same time mentally and physically. And this bill would allow for continued funding to be able to train law enforcement, others in public safety on matters of de-escalation training. Again, given the type of background that members of the military have and the training that they have, one never knows when they knock at a door what might be on the other side of that door. And our hope is that we will continue to meet with successes we have for the last a number of years in the state of Minnesota, that members of the public and members of law enforcement can go home to their families at the end of the day should the need arise to have some intervention and to help with those things. So, Mr. Chair, I have one testifier who has administered this program for us who would like to share a few comments this morning as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sir, I think we met in the lunchroom, but go ahead and introduce yourself and name and title and begin.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Bill Miklas. I'm the Associate Director of the Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute. I served as a police officer for over 30 years in the city of Burnsville, where I specialized in instructing in use of force skills and the department's SWAT team. The Upper Midwest Community Policing Institute is currently receiving funding from the state legislature to deliver de-escalation skills training to Minnesota's community safety personnel to strengthen their ability to manage persons who are in crisis. I want to thank Representative O'Driscoll for sponsoring HF 261, and I'm asking for your support of this bill, which will continue that funding. As you may know, our de-escalation skills training began with a single objective of developing the skill level of first responders when they interact with military veterans in crisis. Minnesota's armed service members, including National Guard and all branches of the Armed Forces Reserves, have borne a heavy burden in recent overseas conflict. The burden for many of these returning has made the reintegration to civilian life more difficult. It is estimated that approximately 10 to 20% of Minnesota's over 15,000 active and reserve service members continue to struggle with post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, or both. Oftentimes that places them in contact with law enforcement personnel with opposing objectives. Today, our de-escalation skills class for community safety personnel has been updated to include teaching methods that will help them manage incidents with persons dealing with certain mental illnesses or behavior disorders, in addition to PTSD and TBI. As law enforcement officers get better at recognizing various types of mental illnesses and behavior disorders, along with the underlying conditions or addictions, they can be better equipped to promote to protect themselves and those involved without the need for using force. In our class, participants learn communication skills, intervention strategies, situational assessment skills, the ability to differentiate between illness-based causes of behavior from criminal-based causes, and measured responses that reduce the need for or reduce the level of force needed to manage the situation while achieving their lawful objectives. At first, our attendance at a class has averaged around 20 persons or less. As awareness of the topic grew, class size increased. Now the average class size is 40-plus participants, with many chiefs or sheriffs asked to have their entire patrol division trained with, by our instructors. Now, attendees include police officers, sheriff's deputies, state troopers, state and county corrections officers, and DNR's conservation officers. They all have a legitimate interest as first responders to develop stronger skills at de-escalating persons in crisis rather than using force to control them. Our goal is to reach a tipping point where at least 25% of the state's 10,500 licensed peace officers have been trained in this program. As maps and the numbers on the maps demonstrate, we are just short of that goal and therefore request additional funding to reach or exceed that mark. We know that number will always be a moving target as officers retire and new officers replace them, but we feel that training a minimum of 25% of the officer population will create a sustainability factor that will institutionalize these practices. I'd like to go back and address your attention to the maps, which indicate the total number of officers of all first responder categories have been trained, as well as the distribution of the training throughout the state of Minnesota. I want to close with two quick stories. When I was delivering training and managing that process to the department of police department in Bloomington, the chief came up to me and wanted to tell me a story of what an officer had done when, after attending our class, he responded to a call at the Mall of America. The security at the mall was asking for assistance in dealing with a person who was in crisis, unspecified at that time. The officer responded. He said he used some of the techniques that he was learned in class just a few days earlier, and they worked. The situation was resolved with little or no force involved, and in the officer's words, the call was handled in a way much different, much better than it was would have been before this training. One more comment to make again. We have partnered with a firm, a nonprofit actually, that deals with mediation. And we've applied some of the mediation training principles to our class as well as additional factors in de-escalating situations once they're at a crisis situation, but we also have a responsibility to prevent them from escalating once situations and the officers are involved make contact with a person. So we're approaching the situations from the top down, crisis to de-escalation down, as well as a dispute level situation from preventing it to go up to a crisis level. Thank you, and I would care to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, we have Representative Johnson and followed by Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nicholas, I don't have a question. I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for the work you've done. Back in 2012, I was scheduled to take that course, but unfortunately funding ran out and they had to cancel it. In 2013, I had an opportunity to sit in on about 2 hours of it. It's a fantastic course. It's the officers I've talked to, they use it all the time, not just for veterans, but in any mental health situation, crisis situation, and the program you put together works very well, and I want to thank you for that.
And Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll, and Mr. Nicholas. I just have one question. Given the complexity of society, the time it takes to do the training, and the urgency to have this training, are we asking for enough money? I'm, you know, those of you who have heard me talk about this before, I am really all about early intervention and prevention. And so my question really is about, are we doing enough? Is this enough money to actually accomplish what we want and need to do? To get ahead of the game.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ward, first of all, I want to thank you for being a co-author on this bill as well. We do have a strong bipartisan support and bicameral support for this. I'll let Mr. Nichols also comment on it, but we originally started at $50,000 per year in the biennium. Mm-hmm. We've now gone, since I've been working on this, to double that money. So the last two cycles, this being the second, we would have gone to $200,000 in training on here. And Mr. Nichols has shared in other committees some ways that they've been able to stretch those dollars. Maybe you'd like to share those thoughts today as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee member. What we've done is recognize that we have competing interests. We would like to schedule more classes and even longer classes, make our one-day class into a two-day. But we're competing with the everyday police schedule. The first responders that have to work can't always get away as often or as long as it takes to teach a longer class. We have done one thing, as Representative O'Driscoll mentioned, by offering a box lunch for each member. We can actually have them stay and listen to resource providers over the lunch period. So they actually get an extra hour for the price of a – we get an extra hour of their time for the price of a box lunch. It works out very well.
Thank you. Okay. We have a couple of people that have asked to testify, Michelle Gross and Kay Smith. Come down separately or together, whatever you'd like. Thank you very much for your go ahead, ma'am, with your name and title and begin.
My name is Michelle Gross, and I'm president of the organization Communities United Against Police Brutality. Our organization has a 17-year history of working on police accountability issues. I'd like to say that we are in support of HF 261, which would mandate de-escalation technique training for community safety personnel. This training is long overdue, and while it will not solve all of the problems and is certainly no substitute for actual accountability measures to address misconduct, studies show that this training has been effective in reducing some of the tensions between police and the community and increasing the safety of both the community members and police officers and other safe, public safety personnel. What people know now from studies is that roughly 50% of people who die at the hands of police are dealing with mental health crisis. This is a fantastic way to give police officers a new set of tools to allow them to address these situations in which everybody can come out ahead and everybody can get the help that they need and everybody goes home safely. We strongly encourage the full funding for this bill, knowing that it will, hopefully at least, again, improve their level of safety and increase the level of trust and reduce tensions within the community. It's a welcome salve for the kind of warrior cop training that a lot of police officers attend now, and that actually escalates problems rather than de-escalates. I am well familiar with, the work of of Mr. Miklas, and his organization does a great job of training. I know he set a threshold of 25%. I would love to see that threshold be pushed higher, frankly. But again, our organization is in support of this bill. Thank you.
Okay, yep. Thank you very much, ma'am, for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Kay Smith, is she with us today? And I've been asked to announce if any of you folks have people coming yet. There's an overflow room in 181 as we've reached capacity in here, 181. I think it has video capabilities. Ma'am, if your name and title and begin, please.
My name is Kay Smith, and I live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm the widow of Jaffert Smith, who was killed by St. Paul police on May 9th, 2016. And I'm in full favor of passing HF 261. I fully believe that the St. Paul police need more training in de-escalation techniques for mental health services. My husband suffered from schizophrenia, and I don't know the full facts of the case yet from what happened in his shooting, but I do know that had de-escalation techniques been attempted, there's the chance that he would still be alive today. So I do really hope that you guys will look at passing this bill so that we do have the chance to provide more training to the St. Paul officers so that going forward we could at least attempt de-escalation rather than lethal force. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Okay. Questions, members?
Mr. Chair, if I might just have a moment to wrap when you're ready.
If there are no questions, go ahead, Representative Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be able to be here. One of the reasons why I don't like to put this as base spending is so we can have conversations like we do today to let folks know that we ask members of the law enforcement community to go out and do a job to keep us all safe and to protect all of our rights. And when you are called out in a domestic situation or other situation, We want folks on both sides of the door to be able to go home happy, safe to their families, whether they're in law enforcement or people who are in need at that point of help and de-escalation and other kinds of services. And so, Mr. Chair, I would ask the committee to give serious consideration, as we have heard, to something that is an area that we are experiencing great success, and these skills can transition into other areas that law enforcement may find themselves in. Mr. Chair, again, thank you for the opportunity and committee for hearing our testimony today.
Thank you, Representative. It looks like a popular bill, and the chair will lay over House File 261 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we have House File 390 and House File 1066, the Zerwas Loehmer bills. They're going to come up together and make a presentation. I've asked the two authors to make short presentations so we give more time for the people up here in the seats to testify if you'd like. Yes, Representative Filson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just for clarification, so they're presenting the bills together, so when people want to testify, they should testify about both bills and any support or concern that they might have with those proposals, and maybe designate which one they have concerns with, Mr. Chair? Or?
That's correct, Representative Filson. We thought because so many of the questions overlap that we've been getting in the email and such that we thought it'd be good, and then when the people come up, they can ask questions about both of the bills.
And then, Mr. Chair, after we're completed with the public testimony, is it your intention then to lay these bills over? Is it your intention to vote on these bills, or what is your plan, Mr. Chair?
These bills will both be voted on with the motion to refer to the General Registry, yes.
So, Mr. Chair, there is no other committee that is requested to hear these proposals. The other bill carried by Representative Zerwas was sent to civil law, but no one else, the Department of Transportation Committee, doesn't want to hear these bills?
To my knowledge, no requests have been made. Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, so I know we're going to have a lot of testifiers to get through today. What is your intention as far as us asking questions? Are we free to ask questions at any point relative to either the author's testimony or testifier's testimony?
Representative Dean, the only thing I can tell you is that we're going to allow numerous people to testify, as many as we can fit in, and the questions also, but we will take a vote before noon. Okay, whichever author would like to begin, go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 1066. This bill is very important to secure public safety moving forward. Unfortunately, there have been some folks in our state who have decided to exercise their right to protest and free speech by blocking freeways and critical access highways near airports. This poses an incredible public safety risk. Number one, to the people who are choosing to protest. Number two, to the public at large. And number three, to law enforcement and emergency responders. So first, I'd like to be very clear about what this bill is not about. This bill does not seek to limit people's right to protest or gather or limit their free speech in any way. It simply increases the penalties for activities that are already illegal. That is, it is illegal for pedestrians to be on these specific roadways. The penalty for breaking this law is currently a misdemeanor, and we are proposing increasing that to a gross misdemeanor. We would like to do all we can to discourage people from protesting on these specific areas. There are so many reasons that this is a public safety issue. I know that there are some who will say when they see an ambulance coming, the protesters will allow them to go through. First of all, it would be impossible to move these people when they are all blocking the freeways with their vehicles. And that's only one reason that there are emergency situations on the freeways. The ambulance is going through. And frankly, claiming that you can let the ambulances go through doesn't even work when you're blocking the freeways. If you see the aerial views, the cars are on the sides of the road and up on the grass, and it is completely blocked when this happens. So it's an absolute just matter of time before people can get through. So this poses grave danger for the citizens who are traveling on our freeways and controlled access highways. A very important thing to keep in mind is that critical access highways are not, not public spaces. You need a license to be on them, both the driver's license and the vehicle needs to be licensed when you're going to. And so when you're going to protest in a public space, this would not be, a freeway would not be considered that public space. So I just want to share a personal story. My son, Nick, who's now 35 years old, was born with spina bifida. And he's had over 80 surgeries to date in his life. Now, one of the issues that people with spina bifida have deal with is something called hydrocephalus, water on the brain. And this is managed by placing a shunt in the ventricles of the brain. And it's been a life-saving invention for individuals with spina bifida. So there are problems associated with the shunts. They can become plugged or infected. And when that happens, they need help quickly. I can recall more than a few occasions where my husband and I would be speeding towards St. Paul Children's or the U or Minneapolis Children's with Nick, who was experiencing the symptoms of a blocked or infected shunt. We were advised to come right away. However, there was never an ambulance call. I can't imagine sitting for hours on a freeway stopped and not being able to get to the hospital in a timely way with a child in a significant amount of pain and no way to move forward. I've recently met a young mom with a child with spina bifida who has a very young son who experiences a lot of difficulties with his bladder, pain to the point of passing out, and they have had to make many trips to the hospital. And to be stopped for hours and hours is beyond cruel. Think about a person trying to get to their job, maybe the nurse in the hospital who's taking care of your critically ill mother or grandmother or child. Think of a courier driving to deliver a long-awaited heart for a transplant. Think of the family flying to the bedside of a dying parent or child, a student on their way to take a final exam, the pilot driving to the airport to fly the plane that you're scheduled to be on, the surgeon on his way to do an emergency surgery for an accident victim, a child with an allergic reaction, which we've had that incident in our family too with a bee sting, a woman in labor. All of these reasons are why this is a public safety issue. Now, I've chatted with folks from law enforcement who have discussed the challenges that they experience when protesters choose to block freeways. This, again, is a public safety issue. Think about this. There's a protocol for staffing. On any given day, police departments and the state patrol schedule a specific number of law enforcement officials to provide public safety for the day. These public servants deal with accidents, domestic violence calls, emergency medical situations, many, many public safety issues. And essentially, they're not available to do the work that we expect them to do, that we've hired them to do, when they're dealing with the chaos that shutting down a freeway causes. So I was really pleased to read several media reports that our governor is supportive of the legislation that addresses the freeways and critical access highways in this bill. And I look forward to working with him on this bill. And again, Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for your consideration.
Members, will be okay if we moved into the other bill and then take questions on both of them. Representative Zerwas, on your bill. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Today I have House File 390 in front of us. House File 390 is very similar to Representative Lohmer's. House File 390 deals with three things that are today, currently, already against the law. It is already today against the law to block a freeway or block access to a freeway. It is today already against the law to block access to an airport. And it is today already illegal and against the law to interfere with mass transit and block a light rail train. Those three things are already illegal. They are a misdemeanor under current statute. What House File 390 would do is increase that misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor. This would stop the revolving door of people being booked, issued a ticket, and released, paying a $50 to $100 fine, and then, in some instances, literally driving right back to the freeways. Now, I've had a few bills dealing with protesters and blocks on freeways and airports. These bills, these concerns were brought to me by constituents, and I'll tell a, a brief constituent story that I told before, but I have a woman that's a constituent in Elk River who was severely ill and was referred to the Mayo Clinic to see a specialist and have a full day of testing down at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. As she was driving from Elk River to the Mayo Clinic, she encountered a blockade on 35W South where several people pulled their vehicles perpendicular to the freeway, got out, and sat down. The freeway was blocked for hours. She called the Mayo Clinic, informed them that after waiting for 3 months to see this specialist and have these tests done, that she would not be able to make her appointment. And they told her the next day that they could get her in would be another 3 months. And so she waited for 6 months to get to the specialist, to get diagnosed, and to get treatment. Because some people believe incorrectly that they have a right to camp out on a freeway to impede traffic and to bring everything to a halt. If you believe you have a First Amendment right to block a freeway, you are mistaken. That is against the law. Already. House File 390 would not make blocking a freeway illegal. It's already illegal. House File 390 would increase the criminal penalties. As you're aware, in our criminal justice system, criminal penalties are to serve two purposes: to deter illegal activity or to punish the offender. Clearly, a misdemeanor has done neither. And so it's time to increase the criminal penalties. A gross misdemeanor would require the offender be booked and would increase the fine, and that is what is required to deter this illegal activity. This bill makes no impact on someone's constitutionally protected First Amendment rights to protest. We've had dozens and dozens of protests over the last few months in which nobody was arrested, in which nobody marched onto a freeway, in which nobody blocked a train, in which nobody blocked access to the airport. This bill would not be a factor in any of those constitutionally protected First Amendment free speech events. In fact, the only time this bill would impact you is if you purposely march onto a freeway, if you purposely take to the entrance of an airport to block access or egress, or you purposely prevent people from boarding a train or allowing the train to move forward. That is not constitutionally protected free speech under the First Amendment. That is, in fact, a violation of current law. That is what this bill is. That is what this bill does. I urge the committee to pass it to the General Register. As I wrap up, Mr. Chair, along with Representative Lohmer, I want to publicly thank Governor Dayton's strong remarks in support of having increased criminal penalties on protests that impact freeways and shut down airports. I think that is the right public policy position to take, and I commend the governor for being on the forefront of this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay. Questions from members. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lohmer and Zerwas. A couple of quick questions. You preface a lot of your testimony about safety and making things safer for not only the protesters but also for the general public. And the stories that you told were about access and being able, someone able to get where they need to get. You say that this does nothing to change the law except to increase penalties. And so I'm wondering what studies you've looked at that make it clear that increasing penalties will actually act as a deterrent for individuals relative to protesting. If you could cite those, that would be great.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Dean, it's basic criminology and basic criminal justice studies that show there are two reasons for a criminal penalty. It is to deter the activity and to punish the offender. What I said, Representative Dean, is that it's clear that this current misdemeanor does not deter, and I do not believe the penalty is enough of a punishment for closing a freeway. That is why I'm bringing this bill forward. If you block a freeway, you should go to jail.
Representative B.
Mr. Chair, I know you studied criminology, and I truly believe that the second reason, punishment, may actually be your intention. Ultimately, my question is, what studies are you looking at and referring? I know there's some folks that walk around that anecdotally thinks that if we increase a penalty, that people are going to be less likely to commit what I would say are smaller offenses. And if the intention of your bill is to increase public safety, that can be done in other ways. I've been involved in some events that, quite frankly, did not plan on doing any type of blockade on any roads or any things. And officers were close by. The organizers of the demonstration informed officers what the intent of what they were to do. And the police actually responded to help accommodate those demonstrators for marching, whether it's through downtown Minneapolis or other areas. So there are ways to address public safety issue. In those events, the officers were able to redirect traffic and to allow people to get to where they wanted to go without much inconvenience. So again, my primary question, I would hope that if you're bringing a bill that's clearly about deterrence, by increasing the penalty, that you would have brought a study that could actually show that this would be effective.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, could I just answer?
Just a second.
Okay.
Representative Zerwas and Lomer, before you begin, if we could have the crowd not give reactions, positive or negative, I'll make sure when you folks get up to testify that everybody remains quiet and shows no disrespect for you. Go ahead, Representative Lomer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dean. I guess I would just say I don't have any studies here, but I know that what is currently happening is that these folks are arrested and they're brought to jail, and they are back on the highway within an hour. And that is not helping. Yeah, that's I talk to people who in law enforcement who have been there. So if they're charged with a gross misdemeanor, that's not going to be possible for them, and so it's easier for law enforcement to clear the highway, people not coming right back.
So let me respond. I know people that were arrested on 94, and they spent the night in jail. They went back out in an hour. So you may have different experiences. These are people I know personally, not hearing from an officer what had happened. These are people I know personally that happened to. So I think we've got many different scenarios of what has happened at times, and
Mr. Chair, to be clear.
Excuse me.
Representative Zerwas, go through the chair, please.
Yes. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. So when we make these types of indications, and don't get me wrong, the story of you with your child, I would certainly think it would be a tragedy if you weren't able to get him to the hospital. And for this woman who is going to the Mayo Clinic for her appointment, and maybe this is a question for Representative Zerwas. Would increasing the penalty for these individuals, would that allow the freeway to be open if even individuals, because they believe that because of some injustices, that they have a duty, to disrupt things? Would she have been able to get to the Mayo Clinic if the road would have been blocked?
Representative Zerwas?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we have a duty to provide public safety. I believe this bill will do that. We may disagree. We may have a disagreement. And that's okay. And that's okay if that's what this process is before. But I fully believe that it is not legal to block a freeway. It is not legal to close down an airport. It is not legal to interfere with mass transit. That's what I know, and I believe that. That is happening. I'm trying to deter it. You might not think that I have the best approach. That's okay. We're going to agree to disagree on this one.
Representative Pinto, let's try to keep our questions and answers short and concise. Go ahead, Representative Pinto.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I do want to do that to get to the testifiers, but I do have to ask this point about the revolving door. Representative Lohmer made it as well. Can you point to any person at all, arrest records are public, to anybody for whom that was true, that they were arrested and that they went back out on the highway? Because I just... Because I just tack on to that. So you say it's clear that it doesn't deter, but of course, you know, we don't know. Maybe the protest, maybe there would have been more people on the highway if it hadn't been a misdemeanor, hadn't been illegal. Nobody's disagreeing that it's unlawful. The question is, does it in fact deter? And the fact is, I don't believe that states with the death penalties have less crime or fewer murders. And this would be the kind of thing that you could point to. So I'd like a response on that.
Representative Lohmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto and Representative Dean, again, I wasn't telling you an anecdotal story. I know personally people who were on Highway 94 when the protests were happening that were working. I know them very, very well. They're close people to me who told me the same people that they arrested were back within an hour. You know, I don't have their names. He didn't give me their names, but I was told that. It was a personal experience from someone I know very well, so I'm not just, it's not anecdotal.
Representative Pinto, follow-up?
Thank you, Ms. Julius. I'm still looking for an answer to my question, though. So revolving door, can we point to anybody at all, who in fact was in that situation? They arrested because you talk about it, they turn around and go right back on again. We know people spent the night in jail. Misdemeanor does mean that you spend time in jail, to your point, Representative Zerwas. Can you point to anybody for whom that was true?
Mr. Chair and members, I didn't bring arrest records with me today to discuss, Mr. Chair, members, but we do know that this has not proven to be a deterrent, and I think increasing the criminal penalties to a gross misdemeanor will help deter that illegal activity in the future.
Follow-up.
And so just to say, I think that if you're going to be advancing this, you should be able to identify. We can talk generally about it a while. We kind of think it probably makes sense. Should be able to identify something to actually back that up before increasing penalties and going after folks in this way.
Your Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask both of you, do you celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I do. It's actually my birthday, too.
Representative Zerwas, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I have been to MLK events in the past. I have been to different public commemorations. This bill is not about anything other than keeping the freeways clear, airports open, and the trains running. And any attempt to make it about anything else is an inaccurate distortion.
Representative Becker-Finn, do you have a follow-up?
Well, that was a simple question and a very long answer. So for me, I celebrate Dr. King and that day by reading some of his writings. Have you read Letter from Birmingham Jail? It's a yes or no.
Representative, what was the question, Representative?
Letter from Birmingham Jail. It's perhaps the most famous of Dr. King's writings, and I'm asking them if they have read it.
Mr. Chair.
You can answer that if you wish. Go ahead.
I have.
Representative Lohmer.
So this letter was written by Dr.
Becker-Finn.
Thank you. So this letter was written by Dr. King in jail after he had been arrested for peacefully protesting, and one of the issues that he addressed in the letter is why he was in Birmingham. And his answer to that question was that I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. And so the reason we've had additional protests is because there is injustice here. When we talk about what happened on 94, it's because there is injustice here. And until we address the underlying injustice, we're going to continue to have dissent. And so instead of trying to further stifle dissent by increasing penalties, this bill is basically going to do the opposite as far as addressing those injustices. And so my other question for you is, why do you think that people took to 94 in St. Paul last year?
Either one of you.
Mr. Chair, members, I know there's been instances where protests have happened out of extreme passion and rage and anger and grief and sadness. I understand that. That's not lost on me. I also know that protests and blockades and freeway shutdowns have been done because someone thinks they should get a $15 an hour minimum wage. And I also know that the freeway was shut down earlier or late in November because people didn't like the results of a presidential election. And I know that freeways and blockades and roads were shut down because of strikes and labor activity. I know that public disruption and everything grinding to a halt and blocking freeways and closing airports and closing the light rail gets a lot of attention. It has become the go-to move for protesters. I know there were claims of people not being able to get state fair votes, and that's why the state fair was protested. That proved to be anecdotal. So I guess what I'd say is there's a multitude of reasons that someone may choose to violate the law. But it's still illegal. It hasn't been deterred. And that's why we need to increase the criminal penalties.
Representative Becker-Finn, follow-ups.
So I had specifically asked about 94 in St. Paul last year, and it's my belief that people took to the streets because they believed a grave injustice had occurred in the unnecessary killing of a young black man. And the folks at this table and yourselves and many other people who serve in this legislature don't live in the same world as the people who took to the streets. And so I just wanted to make that point, that it wasn't to annoy people. It wasn't because you're trying to harm somebody trying to get to the hospital. I mean, we're truly talking about life or death issues here, and that is why it is so important to folks. And so finally, I just wanted to share quickly some additional words from Dr. King. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. So my last question for you is, what level of dissent or protest would be convenient enough for you?
If you choose to answer, could you short answer, please, Representative Zerwas, and we'll move on.
I would recommend people stay off the freeways, don't block airports, and don't interfere with mass transit.
Okay. Any other questions from members? All right. Representative Ross.
Just one. I guess in all the emails that I've received, there's all been concerns about the freedom of speech. And looking at that, having been one who has served in the armed forces, served in law enforcement, and took the oaths to protect our freedoms. I've even been willing to lay my life down for that, to protect everyone's freedom here, and to protect friends, neighbors, whether they like me or not. The emails were concerned with that, and I looked at both these bills closely, and these are a matter of law, not a matter of freedoms, not a matter of free speech. It is trying to help protect your friends, your neighbors, your family members who are traveling, who are moving about, who need to get to places. So to bring this to any place other than a matter of increasing a penalty for breaking the law, I guess I can't see that. Everybody has their freedoms, and I agree with that 110%. But these bills don't interfere with people's free speech to gather peaceably and to protest. If you need to protest, just do it. I served to protect those rights. I was willing to lay my life down, and so are my children willing to lay their lives down to protect those rights. So I look at these and they don't interfere with people's rights to protest or to gather peaceably.
Okay, if you authors would give up the bench for a second for the start of our testifiers. Thank you very much, and we'll bring you back when it gets later in the hour. Teresa Nelson, the legal director of the ACLU of Minnesota, are you here? If you could state your name and title, ma'am, and begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal director for the ACLU of Minnesota. We are a statewide organization with over 38,000 supporters here in Minnesota. We oppose House Files 390 and 1066 because they are aimed at quelling dissent, they're unnecessary, they will have a chilling effect on the exercise of constitutionally protected speech, and they prescribe punishments that are vastly out of proportion to the offense. You have my written testimony, so I'm just going to kind of go over highlights in the interest of time. I know there's a lot of people who want to testify. But over the past year, we've seen an historic level of activism and protest that spilled out onto our nation's public streets, sidewalks, and parks. And those are places where our First Amendment rights are at their height. Unfortunately, we've also seen legislators all over the country react to this historic level of activism by introducing bills such as House File 390 and 1066, in an attempt to enact heavy-handed punishments that are designed to chill speech and silence dissent. On their faces, they're aimed at what can be called criminal behavior, right? Obstruction of a highway. But these are specifically and explicitly aimed at conduct that is closely linked with expressive speech and conduct. Now, over the years, throughout our history of this country, we have seen acts of civil disobedience, from the Boston Tea Party to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, to students shutting down campuses during the Vietnam War, to the Sacred Stone Camp, Standing Rock, and Black Lives Matter protests today. And even though during the time a lot of those protests did not garner significant public support, we now celebrate many of them as important turning points in our history. Now, proponents of these bills say we need these bills to protect the public, to keep our freeways running, but we've already got laws on the books to address these issues. We have laws, including criminal laws and penalties, to address these issues. And make no mistake, police do have a responsibility to facilitate First Amendment activities. And so they do have both a responsibility with traffic, but also to facilitate speech. We also believe that House File 390 and 1066 will have an unjustified chilling effect on speech. The prospect of facing a year in jail will likely deter a lot of people from participating in demonstrations, even demonstrations that have no intention of going out onto highways. It's too big of a price for people to pay to participate in demonstrations. And lastly, I'll just say that these bills prescribe punishments that are vastly out of proportion to the conduct at issue. If you're supporting these bills, if you're supporting gross misdemeanor punishment for obstruction of a highway, what you're saying is that people who largely cause inconvenience to others should be punished the same as people who are found guilty of assault in the fifth degree, domestic assault, a second offense of domestic assault, false imprisonment, criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree, and malicious punishment of a child. Put simply, the punishment does not fit the crime, and I respectfully urge you to oppose both of these bills. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, ma'am. We have question from Representative Pinto.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll be quick. Ms. Nelson, thank you for your testimony and for your work. I have a correction, I think, though. I think there's an error in your document. You say this would be the same punishment as a person who's found guilty of assault in the fifth degree and domestic assault without a prior conviction, and you kind of alluded to this. Those are actually misdemeanor crimes. So the way this would work is somebody who blocks the door to a transit vehicle, like an open door on a light rail car, restricting passenger access, that person would get a higher punishment than someone who assaults their girlfriend or their spouse in the first incident. Am I understanding that right, and can you correct that error?
That is, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, that is correct. In the interest of expediency, I just put the statutes down, but you are correct. The first offense for both domestic assault and fifth degree is a misdemeanor, and the second offense is a gross misdemeanor. So you are absolutely correct.
Okay, now do we have questions from the we have Representative Howe and Gross. Were they comments or question to the Okay. No? Okay, the next person, Michelle Gross, welcome again, and your name and title just for the record, even though you testified once.
Thank you again. My name is Michelle Gross, and I'm president of the group Communities United Against Police Brutality, and again, we're an organization that has a 17-year history of working for police accountability. I thank you for allowing me to testify previously and now to testify on HF 390 and HF 1066. Essentially, these bills were written to increase the penalties for blocking the right-of-way and essentially adding increased penalties for airports and adding a new, essentially new crime of interfering with transit systems to areas, you know, that would be a crime to obstruct. Ms. Nelson talked about some of the constitutional issues, and she talked about the chilling effect of these measures, and I expect other people will likely refer to those as well. But as an activist, I wish to talk about the practical implications of these bills. On March 7, 1965, roughly 600 civil rights marchers set out to march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. This is very personal to me because about 10 years ago, there was a renewed campaign for civil rights, and I marched on the Edmund Pettus Bridge with Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth and others. And so this is quite personal to me. In what has come to be called the Bloody Sunday, these marchers were set upon by brutal police wielding billy clubs and tear gas as they approached the Edmund Pettus Bridge. 2 days later, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, for whom the street in front of our Capitol is named, led a march up to the bridge, but the protesters were violently turned back again. Finally, protesters sought a court order allowing them to cross the bridge and march on the highway. Federal District Court Judge Frank M. Johnson, Jr. weighed the right of mobility against the right to march and ruled in favor of the demonstrators. He stated, quote, "The law is clear that the right to petition one's government for the redress of grievances may be exercised in large groups, and these rights may be exercised by marching, even along public highways." As a result of these marches, the Voting Rights Act was passed just a few short months later. If HF 390 and HF 1066 had been the law in 1965, marchers would have been subject to harsh penalties of up to 1 year in prison and a $3,000 fine each. If these bills had been law, Rosa Parks would have been subject to prosecution for either public nuisance or even for unlawful interference with transit for her courageous act. If these bills had become law even last year, recent protests at the airport in support of our immigrant neighbors and against the Muslim travel ban would have been rendered illegal. The Boston Tea Party was a civil disobedience in which protesters not only destroyed property, but blocked the public waterway, which is also included in these bills. You see, you can't really have it both ways. Protests that block highways may well be an inconvenience, but inconvenience does not come close to the underlying horrors that spur these protests in the first place. Blocking highways may not be popular, but the reality is popular tactics don't bring about change. We urge you to reject HF 390 and HF 1066. Again, these things will do nothing. You know, dedicated young people who want to protest are going to protest. All this does is clog up the legal system with people whose heartfelt feelings about justice are not being addressed in other ways, and these bills are just wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, do you have questions?
Thank you for your brevity. No, we're good to go.
Thank you.
The shorter we can keep the answers, I would like to get many people to testify as you can from a whole cross-section of you folks. So your briefness in your testimony is sure appreciated. But the next one, person will be John Erickson, Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Welcome, sir, for your name and title.
Good morning, Chair and members. John Erickson, here as a representative of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I've been a lawyer for over 40 years. I spent over 10 years as a prosecutor, 10 years as a public defender and a chief public defender. I served on the State Board of Public Defense for 8 years, and I've had a private criminal practice for over 20 years. So I'm here to register our concern, MACDL and mine personally, against the two bills. I've heard some discussions about whether or not this type of change in the law from a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor will act as a deterrent. I will tell you anecdotally and statistically, it will have zero effect as a deterrence. I have never had a client tell me, you know, if this would have been a gross misdemeanor rather than a misdemeanor, I wouldn't have committed the crime. It will have zero effect as a deterrent. However, when you go and move something from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor, you will have potential collateral consequences for that individual that may bear out in things like housing, jobs, and all of this will lead to people becoming more dependent upon state support and push them in towards poverty, because criminals and people with criminal records get pushed into poverty. The collateral consequences from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor can be significant. And I suggest to you, you don't want that effect. You already have laws in place, as these bills illustrate, to force and to punish and to deal with protesters that get out of line. You don't need to move this thing from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor, and it will not make a difference. MACDL and myself speak out against these proposed two pieces of legislation. We don't think it's the right thing to do at this point in time. I'll leave it to the others to talk about the liberties and the like. And I'll answer or try to answer any questions anybody might have.
Question? Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a study that shows that it will not deter?
Sir, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm not aware of any of the studies that will go one way or the other on that, just as has been already been brought up. So my answer to that question is the same as legislators' kind of attempted response was, I don't have one, okay? But I've never seen one, and I've gone to numerous continuing legal education programs that would deal with these types of things, and I've never seen or heard one. But I can tell you anecdotally, no, it will not deter. Zero. Zero effect.
Sir, I guess a quick question then would be, are you suggesting we raise it to a felony? Are you saying that no penalty does any good for deterrent ever that we have on the books? Nothing is good for a deterrent, or where do you draw the line?
Well, there is lines out there somewhere, and if you want to make it a felony, you certainly can. That would be a wrong thing to do as well. But if you think that this piece of legislation will act as a deterrence, I'm suggesting to you, anecdotally and otherwise, it won't.
Okay. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going down that line, sir, if it will not deter, then it will not interfere with the free speech rights that everybody's been sending me emails on, because it won't stifle it. It won't prevent them from the other testifiers that gave testimony, said that this will have a chilling effect on the First Amendment. You just had just now testified that it will have no effect. I'm confused here. Help me out of that quandary that you just posed us.
Sir, go ahead.
I heard, and I forget the gentleman's name, the representative's position on deterrence and punishment. And he made it very clear that he felt that moving it from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor would act as a deterrence. I'm just simply saying to you that I have no anecdotal evidence to suggest and support that. None. When it comes to moving something from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So going down that line, so then it has no chilling effect on the First Amendment then either?
Well, I think there is...
You can't have one without the other. Is that not true?
Sir,
either it has or it doesn't.
Answer, sir.
Thank you. My concern then moving forward from that is the collateral consequences of a gross misdemeanor. And so what you have here is a situation that I would suggest you will not act as a deterrent, but if you make it a gross misdemeanor, it will definitely have collateral consequences that you should be aware of, and I don't think it would be an intended result that would be wanted.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, we have this new tool called Google, and it just went on. In 2013, there was a study by Daniel S. Morgan, and this is on the National Institute of Justice, and he gives five things about deterrence. And the things that actually deter crime are increased perception that criminals will be caught and punished. The police deter crime when they do things that strengthen our criminal's perception of the certainty of being caught. But the fourth one is increase of severity of punishment does little to deter crime. It says that law and policies designed to deter crime by focusing mainly on increasing the severity of punishment are ineffective, partly because criminals know little about the sanctions for specific crimes. So more severe punishments does not chasten individuals convicted of crimes. In prison may exacerbate recidivism. So we may actually be having the exact opposite effect of what we're trying to do here as far as increasing penalties, having individuals be locked up for a year, thus beginning to increase recidivism because of those types of things. So there are studies out there, and I'm guessing someone over there is looking for a study that says exactly the opposite of what I just said. But there are studies out there.
All right. That would be an interesting conversation that if we reduce all the penalties across the board, it would reduce crime, you seem to be suggesting. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just point out, Representative Howe and members, I don't think that there is a conflict at all between the two, and that you can have people whose free speech rights are being chilled. They don't go to a lawful protest out of fear as penalties are being increased, et cetera, and yet I think the point that's being made is for some people, if they're determined to express the concerns they have with injustice and inequities that they see. So the point is, if we're thinking that increasing this is then going to remove this as an issue and people are going to be speeding on along, that may well not be the case based on this testifier, and yet still there may be people whose free speech rights are being chilled. There's no conflict between those two positions.
To interject a thought here, I can remember many on the DFL side voted along with me to increase penalties many times in my 15 years here. So going on your current method of thinking, either it does or it doesn't deter crime, or why did you vote that way? And we can find those votes on record where you have increased the severity of crimes quite a bit. So I wonder what your theory is going to be when those records are drug up. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just, a couple of thoughts on that. We have some new members on the committee who've never voted on any of those things. Some of us wouldn't have voted to increase penalties. But another unintended consequence, and I'm concerned about those as well, the people that we're talking about would often be in a position to suffer greatly to have any kind of of criminal activity on their records in terms of housing and jobs, and then we've had great discussions about the prison population issues and the cost associated with that. I think we're creating a huge web here that we really don't want to touch.
Hey, sir, I think we're done with you. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
The comment before the next person comes down about protests, that some of you are mentioning the name of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. I do have his biography in my desk, earmarked, highlighted, a great man. And I have pictures of him when he was being assaulted. And I've also marched in protests. Back in the 80s, we had a union contract that went down the tube because of a decision here, and I put on a sweatshirt with a whole bunch of other law enforcement folks, And we marched up around the Capitol and made such a ruckus that the governor at that time called and wanted us fired. So I just wanted to let you know that I support protests, but what we're talking about here is protests that block the freeway and airports and rail, things like that. So I just kind of draw the line there, and just to let you know that there's many of us that do support your protests and your testimony here today. So just to keep the bills in perspective, what they actually do. We have, is it Manolan Howley? I probably butchered that name pretty bad, but if you can go up and correct that in your name and go begin, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Manolan Howley. I am the Policy and Organizing Coordinator at Outfront Minnesota. Bonjour, my name is Indigenous. So, Outfront Minnesota was founded in 1987 in response to increased prevalence of violence against the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community. Our mission as an organization is to create a state where LGBTQ people are free to be who they are, love who they love, and live without fear of violence, harassment, or discrimination. Over the last decade, Outfront Minnesota has engaged more than 2 million Minnesotans in our fight to make a more equitable Minnesota. Now, the LGBTQ community and our movement has a strong history of direct action. From Stonewall to the fight for the right to marry the ones we love, our community has always been in solidarity with those people who protest. And let's name those people, because they have not been named in this committee today. Black Lives Matter. Native Lives Matter. Transgender Lives Matter. Our immigrant communities matter. And as an organization, when we think about intersectionality and justice, we cannot stay silent when these bills are targeting a community specifically who are looking for justice. And that is what we are looking for. We are highly opposed to raising the stakes. We already have laws on the books. Well, people know those laws are on the books, and you are not addressing the underlying social stigmas that keep people that activate people to protest and to stand up for their voices. As an Indigenous person, I've often found it difficult to stand and say I am proud of this country because this land was stolen from my ancestors. But I firmly believe that it is the movement of young millennials and underrepresented communities that stand up and they say, hi, we do believe that this nation was founded on the belief that we can pursue happiness. We can stand up together and be diverse and beautiful. And when people march on those highways, that is what they're standing for. They're not doing anything to inconvenience people. And by raising this, you are not addressing the actual issue. And so I urge these members to address the issues of racial disparities, to address the issues of police brutality, to address the issues of homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia. And that is where we should start that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If there's no questions, we have another list here. Amanda Davis. Are you here, ma'am? One more thing to that list. Representative Russell?
I'd just like to add one more group to that list of the lives that matter. The unborn. Those lives matter, too.
Okay. Amanda, do you go ahead with your name and title, who you represent, and begin.
I will. My name is Amanda Davis. I am from Elk River, the town that Nick Zerwas represents. Nikki graduated a year ahead of me, and I think we shared an English teacher. You might recognize these words of hers. Quote, I am troubled by your bill to thwart the efforts of citizens to protest injustice. Those who have the commitment and courage to demonstrate in public and to draw attention to what is happening in cities and neighborhoods should be commended, not punished. No progress is made in the world if men and women don't stand up and demand it. Should the civil rights activists have stayed off the highway at the Pettus Bridge outside of Selma? End quote. This is a comment she made to your Facebook page out of concern regarding this and similar legislation that you've introduced. You might recall that you responded to this question about the Pettus Bridge. Quote, they had a permit for that march. I see two possibilities here, that you made that comment sort of flippantly, and as a, I guess, a bad joke, or that you honestly believe that and you do not see the direct line between those protests at that time that we all have lauded and we've all praised Dr. King for here today, and the protests of the Black Lives Matter movement. So I guess I have a question for you. Which of those two?
We don't allow questioning of the members historically, but you can go ahead and say anything you would like.
Sure. Well, I guess that's my question, and you could answer it if you want to, but either of those are unacceptable to me.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, ma'am. And we have Erica Leversedge. These are sent to us in handwriting, so I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name.
You got it very close. My name is Erica Leversedge, and I am a mere citizen of St. Paul. I have no expertise on this, but I'm concerned. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be heard today. I'm going to speak in opposition to House Files 390 and 1066. This past Friday, Senator Mitch McConnell, whom I have great respect for, said during a press briefing, "I don't go down to Lafayette Park every day, but I'm told there's somebody there protesting something on any given day." This illustrates that if people, including lawmakers, are so unaffected by protesting that the protesters' voices are unheard to the degree that nobody even knows what is being protested, then the protest is rendered ineffective. I'm sorry, my voice is going to shake. Public speaking is not my strength. The point of protesting is to be heard. People gathered in a park are not heard. People blocking traffic are heard. People blocking highways are heard. Elevating the offense of obstructing transit and obstructing traffic on highways or highway access points from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor makes the penalty for effective protesting too high. We ought not, through threats of high fines and long prison sentences, scare Americans into not protesting. Doing so, in effect, silences the voices who want change. We don't have to agree with the change being sought. We can effectively and actively and vigorously disagree. We ought to, however, regardless of our politics, support the right of Americans to shine light on the issues they deem important. Is the highway being blocked inconvenient? Does do so pose a small public safety risk? Yes. I personally don't support the act of obstructing a highway. I don't. Or traffic in general. But I recognize that there are issues that are of such great importance to some communities that they feel compelled to do so in order to be heard. In exchange for my tolerance, in exchange for my inconvenience, I expect to be able to protest and be heard should I ever feel the need to do so. Each one of you also enjoy that right and freedom. Should any of you feel the need to obstruct traffic and protest, I will stand up for your right to do so without harsh penalties, even if I don't support your issue. Protesting is a long tradition in America. It is a right fought for by the great women who serve in our military. We need to continue to honor the sacrifices they have made by upholding one of the rights they fought for, to be heard. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak. God bless America.
Thank you very much. Folks, we're going to take a vote about 5 to noon, and the list is growing, so it sure help the others behind you if you would keep it short. Some of you, I noticed, have brought several pages. If you could condense your thoughts before you come up, that would be great. I just wanted to warn you that ahead of time. So our next person will be Kay Smith, or was that the one we just had? Kay Smith. Again, if your name and who you represent. And
again, my name is Kay Smith from St. Paul, and I'm the widow of Jeffrey Smith, again, killed by St. Paul police on May 9th, 2016. The first time I protested was when a vigil was held after Philando Castile was killed in July, and it wasn't done because protesters wanted to protest. It was done because a man had just been killed by the police unfairly and unnecessarily. I was there because I had been through a horribly and similar situation, and it had gone unnoticed, and I wanted to stand up for this man and his family with everyone else. We stood up and stood together like so many had done before because we are guaranteed the right to do so by the First Amendment. This protest wasn't planned, but it happened because people were hurt and they were angry, and the vigil turned into a protest. They wanted, and we wanted, answers, and we wanted change. HF 390 and 1066 are trying to limit our guaranteed First Amendment right and limit our voices being heard. Blocking the freeway may be an inconvenience, but police killing people is far worse and is an inconvenience in our life, too. Imagine what an inconvenience it was when the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension knocked on my mother-in-law's door 2 days after my husband had been killed to notify us of his death, and the phone call that I received at work to let me know that he was dead, and the fact that 10 months later I still don't know exactly what happened that night. That's been a huge inconvenience to my life. And the fact that this happens in many other people's lives is also an inconvenience. So shutting down the freeway and shutting down transit and things like that, I understand that's an inconvenience, and we all understand that. But it's not done to inconvenience people. It's done to make people take notice. I urge you to reject HF 390 and to reject HF 1066 so that myself and other young people and other members of the community can stand up for what we believe in and can force other people to make changes in today's society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Clint Connor, you are here. Your name and who you represent, or if it's just on your own?
My name is Clint Connor. I live in Minneapolis. I'm here on my own behalf and my family's behalf and many of my friends' behalf. First, I'd like to point out that it's fundamentally problematic to me for the first time setting foot in this room and seeing the committee here. There's not a single person of color on this committee. This is a committee designed for public safety, and I think the fact that it's not acknowledged that there are people missing from this committee that are important to voice their opinions, I think it's a problem. I'd also like to point out another problem I've seen, that is with HF 390, proposed by Mr. Zerwas over here, who is the public face for many of these proposed bills. I have a problem with it. It was proposed by 16 people, all of them Republican, all of them white, 87% of them male. Out of the 16 people, the average distance from their residence to the city of Minneapolis and the city of St. Paul where these things happen, 86 miles. We have a bunch of people living far outside the city, far where these things are happening, telling us in the city what to do, apparently. The setting aside deterrence, whether this will deter or not, the intent is the important thing here. And the intent, clearly, is to propose bills one after another that get into the press and that will stifle free speech. This is a major problem. It's a problem that's stemming from our government in the D.C. area all the way here to Minnesota. We have a lot of problems here in Minnesota. One of the things is cold weather. We have a problem in keeping people here in Minnesota. And I think it's a fundamental problem and issue when we are proposing bills like this that are absolutely ridiculous, that are being floated around the national press and making our state look bad. And this committee and the folks who propose this bill are the reason for it. Now, Mr. Zerwas talked about deterrence and punishment. Mr. Zerwas, did the penalty for DWI stop you from driving while intoxicated in 2014?
Usually the rule is going both ways. We don't interject backgrounds or motives or something. You folks have been excellent so far. Let's just keep it respectful for both.
Did deterrence stop you from driving 80 miles an hour in a 60-mile-an-hour zone and up against other traffic while drunk with a 0.13 alcohol content level?
Sir, could you just get to your point?
My point is, what punishment did Mr. Zerwas feel from that?
I'd like to ask Mr. Zuroff. You don't need a lot of questions of the members here. We never have.
Your proposal is to move the penalty from a misdemeanor, which is a DWI, up to a gross misdemeanor, which are multiple DWIs.
Yeah.
It's absolutely wrong, and the intent is clear, and the people will not have it. I think that what you are missing here is that a bunch of white males can only go on so long running this state. And what we need as a white male are more people with a diverse voice and inclusion. And what we don't have here is that. I would accept any questions you have because I'd be happy to answer them. I would like to say also that I have been a resident of many states in my life and a foreign country. I was a resident of New York City, beautiful, wonderful city. The San Francisco area, wonderful place. Tokyo, Japan, absolutely wonderful. Minneapolis, maybe my favorite. And the reason I was able to convince my wife after 14 years of begging and pleading to move back to Minneapolis, St. Paul, is it's a wonderful place, very open and inclusive and diverse. And when we have people that live 86 miles outside the city telling us what should and shouldn't do, I think it's absolutely a tragedy. And you need voices that are representative of the city and that are representative of the people who live in the city, including the 18.6% African Americans and the 10% Hispanics. That we are here discussing this with all the microphones up here and no one with that background able to speak is absolutely a tragedy, and it needs to change right away.
Okay, thank you, sir. I just wanted to let you know that I don't make up the makeup of the committee. The people that elect you folks do, and we've served with people from indigenous background, Hispanic background. Representative Moran used to be here. Keith Ellison, I used to serve with him in the Public Safety Committee. People move in and out, and Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would just point out that my background is Hispanic, and I take offense to your prejudice looking at all of us and just skin deep. That's highly offensive, so I think you should put some thought into your comments.
Okay, our next testifier is Representative Pinto, and then we'll bring up another testifier quick. Representative Becker-Finn?
Just wanted to point out, I'm Native, I'm Ojibwe, and I was not offended, and I thank you for your comments.
Okay. We have Xander Danielson Selty. Representative Pinto,
to the two authors, have they requested a racial impact statement from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission? Have they requested a racial impact statement? Just to the point that was just brought up there, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission does do racial impact statements on proposed criminal law changes. Has one been requested to the point that was just made by the testifier?
Have we received any, are you folks aware of any racial impact statement? No.
I would, Mr. Chair, would respectfully most, if these bills were to move, obviously I hope that they don't, but if they were, I would certainly ask that one be obtained from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission before any kind of vote on the House floor, because clearly there are issues being brought up. We might as well have the Sentencing Guidelines Commission tell us about them. Thank you.
Hey, I know we received them before, even without asking, but I didn't receive any on this one. So, Representative Considine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to speak about these bills, but I think what I'm going to do instead is read from an email I got from a constituent. I did not spend nearly 2 years of my life on active duty in Iraq on 3 separate tours with the Army to witness the prospect of legislative action to restrict and punish public demonstrators. Please oppose this bill vigorously. I have seen firsthand what oppression delivers to people and the sacrifices of life and limb by soldiers. Best regards, Colonel, United States Army, retired Michael Rath.
Okay, thank you, Representative Considine. And now we have Xander Danielson Selty. Do I pronounce your name right, Xander?
Xander Danielson Selty.
All right.
Hello, I am here, not representing anyone. Actually, it's my first time testifying. That's shocking for some of you. I would like to make a few things clearer, coming from somebody who you see around here a lot. I've marshaled for these protests for probably 2 years. I've done jail support for folks that have been arrested. I've helped folks locate cars that have been towed in the process. I would say there's probably a minimum of 4 hours because they all go down there. And if they're actually booked, sometimes they are ticketed and released. But if they are actually booked, it's usually a four-hour process at minimum. The St. Paul 94 shut down this summer in response to Philando Castile was 24 to 48 hours in jail minimum. I know this because I was one of the people that was on call for when folks would get released to give them a ride home. And that was one of the longer stays for everyone that had been arrested. As for the transit piece, Rosa Parks disrupted transit by sitting in the front of a bus. And also, I went to an ELCA Lutheran Worship, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, which I know some of you are members of on this committee. And they had a worship service after Philando was killed that took place at a church right next to the governor's mansion. And I got to meet the presiding bishop, who I think is a great person, who is like the national bishop. And she remembered me from Twitter. But in that, the local bishop mentioned that I had asked her where she was the night before, which was the night of the protest, and she said she was driving home from being out of town. And I didn't tell her that 94 had been shut down. And she said, well, Z didn't mention that 94 would be shut down. And the presiding bishop of the ELCA, a very predominantly white organization, looked at her and said, well, Bishop Lull, were you inconvenienced by the freeway being shut down? Well, yeah. Why didn't Z tell me the freeway was going to be shut down? And the presiding bishop Eaton goes, well, somebody was shot in your city by a police officer. And if that inconvenienced, that caused a huge inconvenience on that family and that community. So the freeway is shutting down. If it inconvenienced you for a half an hour, it inconvenienced you for a half an hour. Perhaps if we tackle the issues, then we won't be shutting down freeways for that cause. We might find other ones that we need to shut down the freeway for. Just throwing that out there. And then she goes, so are you going to pay attention to what's going on in communities that don't look like yours? And her answer was yes. And I still hold her accountable to that to this day. As for bridges being closed and freeways and emergency vehicles not getting through, everybody keeps talking about 35W. Like 8 years ago, 35W fell down. It was closed for 411 days.
We've got three more,
and,
sir. We've got three more on the list because you kind of wrapped
yep.
it up. I want to give everybody.
That's my last point. 86 mile average, cool. I remember when the DFL was in control. It wasn't all fun and games. It was better, in my opinion. But I remember a lot of you who signed onto this bill or your predecessors saying this isn't what works for rural Minnesota. This isn't going to help rural Minnesota like you think it is. And I would question you, and I would always point this out to people. People on this side of the aisle know. I would go, well, you know, we should remember rural Minnesota. I would ask you to do the same about big cities and not just look at it as the scary inner city as it has been portrayed by folks and actually have conversations. I mean, the east side of St. Paul isn't all that scary. And North Minneapolis isn't all that scary. And I know they'd be willing to have you. So, engage in conversations. Because rather than just pushing what you think will work. Because it might not work. And it might actually impact your communities in ways you didn't see.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have, we'll see if we can fit. We'll have to... not accept any more if you've got any more on the list there. We've got enough or maybe too many now. Elijah Harder, Justin Levin, Lewandowski and Karen Nielsen. If you could get into the ready, we'll take those three and then end public testimony and have the authors come up again for close. Elijah, are you here? All right. Elijah, Justin, and Karen, if you could get ready, and then when you three are done, we'll move on. And sorry we couldn't fit any more people in, but go ahead, sir. Go ahead, sir. Your name and...
I'm Elijah Carter from Cottage Grove, Minnesota. My representative is here on the in this committee. I come here... I have bone cancer, and I'm in a lot of pain. I had to be in that amount of pain in order to get here because I can't be on my medication in order to get here. But I'm here because I run a business, and I also, at any time, my spine can break, and I have multiple myeloma. So speaking to a couple issues, one, access to health care. If a road is blocked, yes, it might prevent some people from getting there. But I... personally can say I would rather have the freedom of speech, and I'd rather have the access there. And I do know that when it was blocked, I had to get to the U of M cancer. I got there with a different route. So you can find different routes to get there. Also, at the Mall of America where I run a business, there were protests that shut down our business. And people say, oh, that's caused us so much problem. Well, I can tell you for a fact, I actually made more money when the protest happened. Yeah, we were shut down for 2 hours, but we made more money that day. So these arguments that you're, these anecdotal arguments are just that, they're anecdotal. I'm an actual person telling you that I have cancer. I need access. I still want them to block the roads if there's injustice happening to this world.
Okay, we got two more people behind you. Could you
and that's pretty much all I need to say.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And then Justin Lewandowski. And then Karen Nielsen, and then we'll end her.
Thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Justin from St. Cloud, but I was actually wondering if I could yield the floor to this man here who wanted to speak before me. Is that acceptable? I feel like another white man from St. Cloud should probably be quiet.
You want to take your, can he take your place then?
Is that okay?
Yeah, if he takes your place, you bet.
Absolutely.
All right, whatever. Well,
my name is John Thompson. For the record, I'm Fight for Justice, LLC. I'm also a member of Black Lives Matter St. Paul. I'm not staying because my leg hurt. I wanted to address this bill and try to say what nobody said. This bill is directly aimed at protesters. My 7-year-old son told me to make sure I told y'all this today, that Rosa Parks, that little... protest was planned. It was planned. So what you're doing now, Mr. Zerwalk, take your shovel and dig Martin Luther King back up and dig Malcolm X back up and charge them with protesting. All right? This is nothing but white supremacy in our face, and I'd like to look you in my face, in your face, sir. Also, let me be clear. My friend Philando Castile was shot 7 times by the St. Anthony Police Department with a little girl in the backseat of the car. There was an 82-year-old woman just last week. The Coon Rapids Police Department sicked their dog on her and drug her to their car, arrested her, only to find out that she was in her shed. Jamal Clark was murdered by the Minneapolis Police Department. So if you want us to stop protesting, sir, stop giving us a reason to protest, please. Because until then, you can charge me with a felony. I'll be in these streets protesting. You and white supremacy, sir. And you, sir, indigenous brother, join me. Other than that, you want to stay right here with these white supremacists there. Okay. With that being said, how about we're tired of white supremacy? I'll sit down. We're tired of white supremacy.
Can you wrap up the
week? No. I went long enough. We're tired of white supremacy trying to finesse us with the same ideological points, similar to the same thing that Rosa Parks was going to. All right? We're sick of these white supremacist ideas. All while denying racism in this modern day. This is racism right here. This is blatant dishonesty.
This is blatant dishonesty, and the state of non-whites in America, and serves as a new and impoverished white hood or a mask to shield responsibility and accountability. We put you in office to make decisions to help us. And I'll wrap it up. Because you want me to wrap it up, Mr. Cordes and so, Chairman? I'll wrap it up by saying the same thing I said to you guys the last time I was here. We put you guys, and by the way, I traveled to Elk River just to see how many protests there. There's over 7,000 people in Elk River. They've never seen a protest. But well, I'll put you on my calendar. But in closing, we put you guys in positions. You're right. We voted for you. You got constituents. You got delegates to put you in these positions. The same ones will get you out of them. I'll be coming for your seats. I will be coming for your seats. Get it right. Because all we're asking for is help. My friend lost his life in this state. Murder. Live. Y'all seen it. Live. There's no doubt in my mind he knows murder. All right? So we're going to fill these streets hand in hand. Every time there's an injustice, I guarantee you'll see me. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Trump.
Karen will be our last testifier. And, Karen, could you finish up like in a minute? We have session on the floor in 15 minutes, so we want to
bring the authors back. I was going to yield to Justin. But I did just want to say perhaps that justice is the deterrent and the safety of our community that you might be looking for.
Okay, thank you. Please switch Justin. Oh, Justin, try to finish up in a minute, could you? Because we got to get out.
I will keep this.
I've been trying to get as many as you could. So.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I'm from St. Cloud, Minnesota. Not a lot of us get down here. I just want to also say, though, that I'm floored to know that me and 250 folks in greater Minnesota are now likened to violent criminals when we shut down literally the street of division in St. Cloud, Minnesota, because I'm here today because of diapers. I'm here today because I have organized with my friends in the St. Cloud area over 300,000 diapers in the central Minnesota area because people can't even afford diapers for their kids. In Minnesota, today, it is still illegal that 23% of my community lives below the poverty line. That a majority of those people are people of color. And we're sitting here today whether or not we should be deterring injustice through more heavy penalties for folks like myself who will always stand, no matter what the penalty is, against a law that is unjust. Because I also read Martin Luther King Jr. and I am sick and tired of hearing the whitewashing of history. I will always stand in the streets of division with my community in St. Cloud and solidarity people in Twin Cities. My community is hurting, and when we are bombarded in central Minnesota, and it's still legal for hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy our elections, when people are losing faith in the electoral process, when we have no other recourse than to literally shut down the streets of division in St. Cloud, Minnesota, what are you going to do to make sure that we have faith in democracy again? The deterrent is justice. Let's get some in this house again, huh?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested for the vote. The chair will move House File 390 and House File 1066 to be... We'll do them separately, but we'll move them to the... my move will be to re-refer to the General Register. First one will be House File 390, and a roll call vote will be taken. Roll call on 390.
Chairman Cornish?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Becker Finn?
No.
Representative Considine?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Frankie?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Powell?
Aye.
Representative Lomer?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger?
Aye.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Ward?
No.
Representative Zerwas?
Aye.
Okay. Okay, the tally of the vote being 10 aye and 6 nay, the motion passes, and the House File 390 is moved to the General Register. House File 1066 moved to re-refer to the General Register. Will you roll call vote on that?
Yes, please.
Okay, roll call vote.
Chairman Cornish?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Becker-Finn?
No.
Representative Considine?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Frankie?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Howe?
Aye.
Representative Lohmer?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger?
Aye.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Ward?
No.
Representative Zerwas?
Aye.
Okay, and House File 1066, the vote is 10 aye, 6 nay, and it is moved to the General Register.
Same I do.
Meeting adjourned.